Andrew.
And I'm Spencer, and you're listening to the At a Distance podcast from The Slowdown. Today, we'll be speaking with the Canadian novelist, essayist, and cultural commentator, Stephen Marsh. He is the author of the new book, The Next Civil War, Dispatches from the American Future.
Stephen has written opinion pieces and essays for The New Yorker, The New York Times, The Atlantic, and Esquire. He is the host of the hit audio series, How to Not Fuck Up Your Kids Too Bad, and its sequel, How to Not Fuck Up Your Marriage Too Bad, both on Audible. But today, we're mostly going to be talking about Civil War.
At a time when the United States and the world feel like they're really falling apart, Stephen offers concise and entertaining thinking and clarity that helps us confront head-on some of our greatest challenges. Let's get him on the line. Hi, Stephen. Welcome to At a Distance. It's so great to have you with us today.
Pleasure to be with you.
So let's get right into it. There's a lot of talk in America right now about the potential of a civil war. Your new book, The Next Civil War, is all about that. And before we get into the particulars, I was hoping you could just start with, what is the technical definition or your best definition of civil war?
Well, the technical definition of a civil war that I use comes from PRIO, which is the Peace Research Institute at Oslo, which starts at 1,000 combatant deaths a year. So obviously, the United States is very far from 1,000 combatant deaths a year. The definition of civil strife, however, starts at 25 deaths a year, which the United States has been above for many years. But, you know, the truth is, when you're dealing with a country as huge as America and as just geographically big as America, as well as diverse as America, I'm not sure those numbers make a whole lot of sense. You know, they're just really catch-alls. Also, you know, the definition of what constitutes a political murder is actually really hard to say. Like, were those people in Buffalo who were, was that a political murder? Was Highland Park a political murder? They certainly are not defined that way. So the point is really, like, not that, you know, these technical definitions, that's not really the point. The point is political violence is on the rise. Faith in institutions is in steep decline. And those trends are continuous and they are getting worse. So that to me is scary enough.
And you open your new book with this dramatic but also all too real sentence, the United States is coming to an end. How are you thinking about this particular moment, considering this likelihood of a Civil War scale event occurring? When do you think this current moment we're in began? What occurred? What has gotten us here?
Well, the moment that most of the experts that I spoke to across a number of fields kept bringing up was 2008. That's when the far right really starts to become, you know, not just like some freaks on a Texas ranch that, you know, get murdered by the FBI and then murder each other. Like, it starts to become much more serious. And that's when you get things like the Tea Party, you get anti-government patriots in government. You know, the question is what happened in 2008. So the big one, obviously, is the housing crisis, which hit the American dream very hard. And it became very clear that, like, the next generation of Americans was going to be worse off than the previous generation of Americans, which basically ruins the whole idea of the country. To me, not unrelated factors would be that was the election of Obama. So you had the sort of end of white iconography in the presidential space. And also, I think the surge in Iraq, which was kind of the end of the concept of easy American dominance over the world militarily. So it's a number of things, but they all tend to drive back to 2008.
From a global perspective, if we're moving a little outside the United States, what's at stake here if we were to go into a civil war?
Oh, well, I mean, the survival of democracy in the world, right? I mean, the post-war global order that we have all flourished under has been, you know, international institutions that have widespread validity through, you know, democratic means backed up by American military might, right? So if the American military and, well, also in its economic might, for sure. And if those things no longer belong to a democracy, we're all in a great deal of trouble. I mean, I think the consequences could not be more severe.
So January 6th, mm-hmm. You're working on this current book, still, right? You had not completed it.
No.
And all of a sudden, this incredibly visible moment happens. So I'm really curious what that day was like for you, if you saw it coming, what you were expecting in the days ahead, and how you felt in the days afterwards.
Well, you know, I mean, it is a funny thing because obviously I've been working on this book for a long time and I'd done things like gone and talked to oath keepers and, you know, interviewed Nazis with law degrees. And so I sort of knew where they were at. And it came as no, I mean, certainly the event itself came as no surprise to me. I did think it would probably happen at the inauguration rather than before, because I'd attended the Trump inauguration and I'd seen, like, that was what gave me the idea for the book. I covered it for a Canadian magazine and I was like, oh, well, this is, has very Fall of Rome vibe, right? Like, it has a, like, you know, I'm, you know, at one point I'm like pushed by a crowd on top of a limousine and I'm like furiously trying to take pictures and then the limousine lights on fire. You know, this is not, you know, this is not what you expect when you're usually, when you're sent at, from a Canadian magazine to cover a presidential inauguration. But it came as no surprise to me. I was a little surprised at how chaotic it was and how badly organized it was and how it was not really the, I mean, I hate to use this term, but it was not really the strongest people in these far-right movements who were there. It was actually pretty the weak parts of the far-right movement. So to me, even that day, I felt like it was sort of the 1993 World Trade Center bombing. Like, it was like a premonition of things to come, but it wasn't the serious one, right? It wasn't the one that is really going to shake everybody to their core. So, you know, that comes, I think, pretty naturally from spending so much time with, you know, on this subject. It really was not surprising to me at all.
Right, or scary to you in a way.
Well, I think it's very scary when you have rioters killing cops on the street and you have U.S. senators raising their fist in support of people who are about to sack their institutions. And I mean, it was horrible. Like, don't get me wrong.
Yeah, of course. But I more mean like you didn't think that civil war was starting that day.
No. And I mean, I still to this day think that it's incorrect to call it an insurrection. I mean, like, you know, there are certain technical definitions of what these things amount to. And that does not meet, to me, does not meet the criterion that you would use to describe it as a, you know, concerted political effort. I mean, if it's an insurrection, it's like the Keystone Cops insurrection, right? I mean, like, it was like just such an, like, if you look at like the history of civil wars, like, people plan these things for years before these take these actions. You don't do it on texts the morning of, right? You don't like, hey, are you in Washington today? Yeah, I happen to be. Why don't we overthrow the government? that's not how these things tend to be. So not that there aren't those people. Like, that, not that there aren't those people planning these things right now. I just think, you know, America caught a break that it was Rudy Giuliani in the room rather than, you know, Steve Bannon, who might have had a completely different approach to this. But, you know, I think that's all speculation on my part. My point is really that it could have gone a lot worse. I mean, as horrifying as it was, I don't think that represents, like, the real dangers here. Like, it's going to get a lot worse than that.
Right. And you have a really clear vision of what that could look like. So describe to us what a civil war would actually look like in the U.S. Who's in control? Like, does the military break into? Like, how does this actually work in the U.S.?
There are a lot of different ways it can happen. And the book gives five different scenarios. Like, I would also like to point out, like, I hope in the book I'm very clear that about the limitations of all these models, right? Like, what I do is bring up the best available models. I talk to one of the colonels who was responsible for drawing up full spectrum operations in the homeland, what an occupation of an American county would look like if the military were to do it, things like this. So there, you know, the book does have very specific outlines of what it could happen. Like, in the broad terms, if you're asking me, what it looks like is the forces of order against the forces of chaos, and any attempt to impose order simply leads to more chaos. I mean, that's the nightmare of insurgency and counterinsurgency that the U.S. military has learned brutally over the past 70 years, is that it's essentially an unwinnable struggle. And it certainly would be totally unwinnable in the United States, which is not a controllable place. You know, what that looks like, I think you're starting to see shards of it already. For example, like with the abortion debate versus Roe v. Wade, like, what that is not is a political answer. right? Like what happens is suddenly you have total political chaos, right? You have total administrative chaos, sometimes on a county by county basis in some of these states where nobody knows what the hell is going on. And the legal status of women in County X in Missouri as opposed to County Y in Illinois are actually quite different, right? And it is unclear what is, you know, the American reality around abortion. That's one part of it. The other part is, of course, the rise of violence and the rise of these insurgent groups, and then the attempt to suppress the insurgent groups through means that increasingly are illegitimate because the government cannot maintain, it cannot get to a point where every American believes that there is a legitimate force that transcends raw military might that can actually determine this. And that's very, very troubling. You can see exactly what they look like now. It's just that exact, you know, totally out of control, right? That are what worries me or how I foresee that future. The book is really, you know, it's projections, but I didn't have to make anything up. Like when I want to talk to like a sheriff who is in resistance to the federal authority, I don't have to make up that guy. I can call him on the phone. He's done it. There's lots of them, right? Like when I want to talk to, you know, farmers who feel like there's going to be a major corn shortage, which is a huge humanitarian disaster if the Midwest corn production falls, I don't have to make that guy up. I can just call him on the phone and talk him through it. What I did in the book was based very much on those kinds of detailed interviews from people who are in the middle of this. And so that's why I think it's slightly different than, you know, just like imagining what might happen.
Yeah. And you sort of, you make this strong argument for kind of like the disunited states, like essentially secession. Why do you think this might be a solution? And maybe help paint a picture of what it may look like with, say, Texas and California as different countries.
The problem is that the 14th Amendment is very specific, and the United States actually has these counter mechanisms in its constitution to secession that are extremely severe because of the Civil War. See, I'm from Canada, where there's been an activist separatist movement that's in power currently in Quebec, and we've come twice in my lifetime very close to breaking up. But we have a very, no one would say it's ideal, but we have a clear sense of what it would look like legally. We're not going to do violence. If they vote to leave 50 plus one, we're going to talk about it like grownups and we're all going to go our separate ways and to the best advantage of both parties. The United States has no way of doing that, right? Because of the Constitution and because of the 14th Amendment and because of the other fact that I found just bizarre researching this book is that everybody worships the Constitution. Right. Like that's the one thing about America. Like you go and talk to Texas separatists, you go to talk to California separatists, you go to talk to far right people, like white power people, you go and talk to editors at the New York Times, they all worship the Constitution. Right. They all, you know, when you talk to a Quebec separatist, they're not interested in preserving the spirit and letter of the British North America Act.
No, it's our Bible. We all just read it differently.
Yeah. Well, that it is now effectively become like the Bible, where yeah, the original meaning of the words is actually irrelevant. Like it's strictly sectarian interpretations of texts that are, you know, they're just aged out. It's not a criticism of the Constitution. It's a work of great genius. It's just 250 years old.
There were no AR-15s then. It was a musket.
I mean, that would be example one, but they also thought black people were 3/5 of a person. That would also be like
maybe the first one.
Well, I mean, take your pick. Like there's a lot to take a pick of, you know, so that seems to me even more problematic for how to separate. So when I talk about separation in the book, you know, that's from talking to separatists of various kinds and like trying to roughly imagine what the lines would look like and also going over the real divisions in the country, which are not just political, they're very much sociological, they're even psychological. There are these regions with different profiles, and trying to imagine a scenario where each of these political entities could kind of come into their own, right? Sometimes when I'm in California, I'm like, what would this place be like if it actually had meaningful healthcare? Like it would be unstoppable. It's already pretty unstoppable right now. But the fact that, you know, you've got New York and California who obviously want meaningful social policies that as a Canadian, we take as completely for granted, right? Gun control and healthcare, they don't have them. And the other hand, like the South and Texas, they genuinely feel incomplete resistance to the government. Like, they feel that they are not able to express their political will, right? And that has, you know, crippled them from becoming the political entities they want to be. When a marriage gets to this point, you sit the kids down, you say, look, we had a good run. We still love each other, but, you know, we got to go a different path. And I think America is at that point. Because the other option is violence. I mean, that's why I think it has to be imagined, right? Like, that's why I think it has to be thought through and has to be really considered, as painful as it might be. The one thing when you talk to liberals is that they really don't understand that the other side is in as much pain as them, right? That the other side actually feels under siege as much as they do. And they feel like they're having their country taken away from them, right? Just as people on the left feel that way. And so, you know, that's why I think like some kind of negotiated settlement is the most rational answer. Whether it's the most likely is, you know, very much a matter of debate.
I'm curious to hear your thoughts around what the climate crisis might play in terms of a role in leading to or spurring a civil war. It's shaping a lot of the social and political and obviously environmental conversations across the country. And how do you see the emergency of the climate crisis potentially affecting the political one?
The model that I used here was that I believe in is the complex cascading system. So that means that it's not one factor, it's multiple factors that feed into each other and feed off each other, right? So to give you an example of how climate feeds into this, so you have huge droughts in Central America that lead to this explosion of refugees out of Central America. And there's bad political decisions are made in Central America that do not take into account this coming climate change and lead to an explosion of refugees. The refugees head north. They're a major, you know, major aspect of the 2016 election where people feel that immigration is out of control in the United States. That leads to the election of Donald Trump. One of the actions that Donald Trump takes in the waning days of his presidency is that he cancels the seawall to New York. I cannot begin to describe to you how irresponsible an act that is. People don't talk about it because, of course, there's much more dramatic things that are happening with Donald Trump. But the United States is in possession of the greatest city in the world, and it is not protecting it. And I assure you that that would not be possible in any other country in the world. Not Japan, not China, not Russia, nowhere. Like, the irresponsibility of that act means that a hurricane, which is coming for New York. Northern Atlantic hurricanes have increased by 500% over the past two decades. And, you know, the person I talk to, you know, is a reinsurer. So he's responsible for making projections on models that have trillions of dollars of value, right? Like, it's people who reinsure insurance companies for disasters, right? And he thinks the Northeast is the most vulnerable spot on the world right now of the United States, right? And so, like, if you imagine what would happen if a serious hurricane hit New York. Sandy was not a hurricane. It never got to that strength. It was only a storm. And it caused, you know, roughly, I think it was $250 billion worth of damage. But if a real hurricane hit New York and you created a situation where large parts of the island of Manhattan were no longer inhabitable, and this would also create a flood of refugees into the center, which, you know, the best estimate is that there's going to be about 15 million climate change refugees in the United States by 2050. That creates turmoil. So you see how it all feeds into itself? It's like climate change leads to bad decisions, which lead to bad electoral outcomes, which leads to bad decisions, which leads to climate change having worse outcomes. It's a spiral, and it's extremely hard to stop. I mean, I also think that the general chaos of the world at the moment, I mean, I think a large part of it is that there's this hum of despair in the background, right? Like, there's this just constant hum of it's all going to blow up. And we're living on a dying planet. And I mean, that's more peripheral. Like, that's something you can show. And I wanted the book to be extremely specific, you know, like extremely like this can be demonstrated. You can show how it works. But I think also it's very real that there's this kind of hum in the background of despair that we, all of us, are either succumbing to or resisting, you know, all the time.
And some of it's being thrown in our face with certain Supreme Court decisions that have been occurring. And, you know, the Supreme Court's a subject I wanted to bring up here because it seems like this is almost like a microcosm of the greater challenges we're facing, the division that's happening in this country. And I was wondering if you could consider the Supreme Court and even its recent strike down of Roe v. Wade as sort of some sort of explanation for what we're dealing with or what we're facing.
Well, I think when the Supreme Court loses validity, when it becomes just political hackery and no one in the country really believes that it's a transnational institution, then you have decline in the faith of law. And if you don't have a country where you have faith in the legal system, you honestly don't have a lot. It's not really a question of it being a symptom. It's actually so serious in itself. Like, what causes a civil war? Like, there are many different answers to that. But certainly one of the biggest ones that a lot of people talk about is anocracy. So the shift from, you know, democracies are very stable, autocracies are very stable, but it's when you're in that gray area that violence really gets out of control. And when you read the histories of previous civil wars, like what happened in Chile, what happened in Rwanda, what happened in, you know, all these places, like the first chapter is the Supreme Court lost its validity. That's what happens in all of these places. There's no place to go to settle differences between all of you. There's no common ground. 5 out of the 9 Supreme Court justices were selected by people who did not win the popular mandate. I think it's totally reasonable to not believe that they are a legitimate institution at this point. But when you don't have those legitimate institutions, I mean, that's just a recipe for total disaster. It's absolutely prolegomenon to nightmares every time it's ever happened in history. It's more than just a symptom of these problems. The fact that it only has 25% support in the whole country, this is a disaster in and of itself.
You can't really have a conversation about a potential civil war without talking about guns. And so I did want to bring that up. There's an estimated more than 400 million guns in this country. Where does that number, that sort of data point, fit into this conversation? What does that mean that there is that much firepower?
Well, it's an interesting point because, like, you know, when you talk to FBI people or you talk to the Secret Service about assassination, when I talked to the Secret Service guys and I was like, well, surely it can't be good for you that there's a 50 caliber rifle all over the world. And they're like, well, it doesn't really matter because these are militias who think that they can compete with the U.S. military. They can't. Like, it doesn't matter if you've got 400 million AR-15s, like, you compare it to real Marines, like, with all that they come with and all of their training and what and their helicopters.
Good luck.
It's nothing. Yeah, good luck. Like, well, I mean, I wanted to have a battle scene here. So I was calling all these guys and saying, like, can you talk me through what the battle would look like? And they were like, what battle are you talking about? Like, it's like, we can turn off the water. Like, we can just walk over everyone here. Like, there's no actual battle. That's one point to make, that in terms of an actual resistance movement, I remember reading a story from a journalist who who was in Afghanistan and saw a guy using a 1878 British rifle. The actual, like, the technological stuff is not anywhere near as important as the will, right? Like, if you're actually facing a counterinsurgency that does not want you there, it's pretty much unwinnable. The only solution is Chechnya, right? Like, the Groznification of these places. And, you know, no, I don't think anyone in America is planning on that. So you have the weapons, and on the one hand, don't matter, but what they do matter is as a symbol, because all of them are being purchased, like, these are not hunting. You know, I'm from Canada. 50% of people in Canada own guns. All my uncles own guns because they all live in the country and they all live on farms and they have 22s for shooting gophers or whatever. But it's in no way would those weapons be a symbol of resistance to the government. But here in the United States, they are. So the weaponry itself doesn't matter so much as the symbolism of what it is. I do remember at one point I was trying to figure out how much ammunition there was in the United States, because they have a relatively decent guess at how many weapons there are. But ammunition, like, no one would give me a guess. No one has any idea. The best estimate I was found was over 1 trillion rounds. in the United States, right? And so, like, it was like, how many bullets are there in the United States? Literally uncountable. Like, I mean, right, like, literally they don't have a number.
How many blades of grass are there in the United States?
Exactly. It's like, well, you know, no one's manufacturing blades of grass. You figure there'd be like manufacturers who'd have numbers, or someone would be keeping track, right? Like, so, like, there'd be some government agency charged with, you know, regulating bullets, or you know, just like they regulate, you know, the wine, right? Like, it's a consumer product. Like, surely there would be, no, there's nothing even remotely like that. So, yeah, I don't think the weapons in themselves don't matter, you know, except insofar as they lead to more mass shootings, which leads to more chaos, which leads to more, and these forms are increasingly taking on a political expression, this violence. But the number of weapons matters much less than what they symbolize.
So, I wanted to take a quick, like, kind of hard turn, which is about AI.
Oh, yeah.
Because you recently wrote this piece, which I found really moving, called "Does Artificial Intelligence Really Have a Potential to Create Transformative Art?"
Oh, nice.
Which is a great headline. And I read it the same week I got on board at the DALL-E 2 and was really kind of wondering about this. And we were playing around with it internally here.
Yeah.
And so your perspective on it was pretty refreshing. So I have a few questions about it. First of all, what are you most excited about? Let's start with the sort of optimism of the potential for AI when we're just focused on creative initiatives.
Well, I mean, to me, the large language models and the transformer-based large language models are super exciting. And I don't think we really know what's going on with them. I mean, I know guys from Cohere, which is
Canadian one you worked with.
Yeah, they're the Canadian one I work with, and those are the guys who built transformers at Google and at DeepMind. And then, you know, I've talked with some of the OpenAI, well, not with the OpenAI, guys, with PseudoWrite, which was also a really fascinating program, which I've written. I've used it to write things for New Yorker and so on, and that to me is really exciting. I also think, like, the most exciting part probably is in bots. I think we're going to have creative bots that are, I think that has barely been touched. But, you know, I think we're at a really nascent stage with this. We're where film was when they got, like, the shot of the trains going in and everyone would go and see them. I think the most exciting stuff probably hasn't been figured out now because we're still cannibalizing old modes of art. I use this stuff to write short stories. Like, I did that for Wired in 2017, and I've done a couple of other ones. There is a lot of exciting stuff, although, you know, a major problem is that there's no institutional backing for this stuff. You have no idea where to put it. I guess you throw it on Twitter, but it doesn't quite have the framework for reception that a new medium needs, which is what I really believe this is. So, like, I mean, I'm super excited about this. I mean, I've been working on this for years now, and it just keeps getting cooler all the time.
Totally. And in that LitHub piece, what I found really profound and what I wanted to bring up was that this comparison you draw from AI to hip hop.
Yeah.
And you try and help us understand that there are pieces of this that we have anchors for. We can understand this. So I wanted you to sort of unpack that concept for us.
Well, you know, you're fooling around with technology to get at a new emotion, right? And I think hip hop, specifically production, like not the, like the producer role is what I'm thinking about here, like a Kanye West kind of figure rather than like a Jay-Z. You know, that's what they did. Like the precursors to that, like they had to learn how to manipulate technology to get at emotional responses. And it took them a long time to figure it out, but they slowly built it up through this kind of incredibly honest, audience-focused approach to this work that ultimately resulted in probably the most meaningful genre of music in the 21st century, right? Like AI is not, it violates a lot of the norms that we think of as art. It's not creative, right? Like it's not your own voice. It's, you know, you're using technology and you're using other people's voices and you're using these language models to create effects. So it violates a lot of things that we think about sentimentality of art, which is what happened with hip hop too, right? Yeah. Everyone was like, they're just sampling. They're just like ripping off other artists and they have no voice of their own. And they prove them wrong.
Well, the IP moves from the execution to the provocation, right? It's like the question becomes more important.
But it also moves to manipulation and recombination and permutation. Somebody had to figure out scratching, right? Somebody had to figure out how to build a break. And that's pretty technical. Like that's like, that requires like a lot of understanding of machines, right? And so that to me is the path forward to us. Like we should imitate that, which is hard to do. Like I'm trying to work on my own projects now on this stuff, and it's incredibly hard to find the room to make this stuff. Like even with these guys helping me out, and like, you know, who could ask for better collaborators than the guys, than people who, you know, helped invent Transformer? And these people want to see this flourish, right? So like they're great, but it's also unclear where to put it, how to get at a wide audience for it, what it would mean to people. But you know, it is coming. I talked to a guy at Warner Brothers. They're working on this stuff too. There is going to be a mass reaction of it for sure.
You attached a kind of sidecar to the piece called Auto-Tune Love Story.
Yeah.
And this is what really interests me about AI in the tunnel of creativity. It's like the question becomes really important. Like when you get on DALL-E 2 right now, it's just what question are you asking, right? The provocation. And so I was curious where the genesis of Auto-Tune Love Story came from and how that question came about. Kind of like, why is that the... And maybe tell us a bit about the story, too, which is kind of fascinating.
What it is it's, I had an idea, because one of the things is, you know, I did a piece for the New York Times on using Cohere in Shakespeare, like using these large language models for critical work, which it's incredible at. It's going to be totally transformative of that. But what I thought it was, I'll use this to generate the ultimate love story. To take all of the love stories in the world and break them down and find what was great in them and conjure out of them this auto-tuned love story. Well, it's auto-tuned too, right? So it's also obviously not eccentric, right? Like it's generalized. It doesn't have like the specifics that you might have in a love story. So to do that, you know, I do have a PhD in English, so I have done my oral exams and like I've read all the important 19th century novels, and I know, you know, I've written novels myself. So like I know the craft and I know the references and I know, you know, I got obsessed with Eileen Chang who wrote Lust, Caution and just totally incredible short story writer. Basically, I used Cohere to build bots of these stylistic models, and then I would use them to build these sentences and paragraphs one by one, and then slowly accreting it into this love story, which is 100% computer generated, but is also mine. So you see the connection with hip hop, right? Where it's like, just as a hip hop MC needs to know every album. Like, this is not going to require less literary knowledge to make this work. And it's not going to require less design knowledge. And like, not at all. In fact, what you're going to have to do is you're just going to have to understand literary style from the ground up on a massive scale. And so that's to be able to work meaningfully in this form. And that to me is like when you hear the stories of those like original DJs in the early days of hip hop in the 70s, where they would go on vacations and go all through the islands and pick up every album from every negligible little band on Antigua and bring it back to New York to get fresh samples. That's how I see this progressing. But, you know, that was also just that one experiment. There are other things that can be done that are bolder. The thing I liked about that one is I could do it myself alone, just like a writer. But a lot of them are going to require like real investment, real money. And to build, I actually don't know how that's going to happen. Like, I think we actually are going to need institutions. The humanities departments are totally out to lunch. They have no idea what's going on. Like, I bring up these ideas with people in creative writing departments. I mean, laughed out of the room, right? Totally uninterested in this work. And I would say also like major literary magazines are totally uninterested in this work. There's a long way to go here to get to a space where this can be fought over. Also, you know, because it's tech, there's so much fraud, right? There's so much stupid hucksterism and cheap hustle that ruins everything and makes it so vacuous. Like you meet one real person for every 20 scam artist, basically. I'm sure that was true in hip hop too. right? I'm sure it absolutely was.
So just circling back to the Civil War.
This is a wide range of conversation. My intellectual interests are broad.
Well, this came from like, we knew we wanted to talk to you about the Civil War.
Yeah.
But then it was like, but wait, this AI piece, we got to get into this a little bit. So
yeah.
It was an interlude. We're back to the Civil War.
Maybe there's a way to tie it in here, which is that, do you have any hope that we'll avoid this Civil War or Civil War level situation? Would technology perhaps play a part in that? If so, how? Like, basically, what's your personal assessment of what's in store?
Well, America is an incredibly changeable country. Like, it is the country of reinvention. And I know this sounds so cheesy, but like, if any country can get out of this, it's you guys. Right. Like, I mean that. I remember when I was a kid and I would go to New York and it was so rude. And then one day in like the late 90s, may have been even earlier, it just got polite. It just suddenly got polite. It's like everybody decided collectively, we can't be rude anymore. We're all going to die if we're rude. If we're going to live in this city together, we're actually going to have to be polite on the subway. Right. And those kind of changes, those kind of ground up changes are absolutely possible. I mean, like if there's a country of political reinvention, it would be the United States. I would say, on the other hand, like the trends are going one way. And the next civil war that I was projecting, I thought would be in 2040, right? That was the kind of threshold that I was thinking of, right? Not Wednesday, right? Like not like it's like, I remember because of COVID, I couldn't go to the States. I couldn't report on the States for a year and a half, I think it was, like, which, you know, I worked for Esquire for 8 years. I was a professor in New York briefly. It'd been a long time since I spent that long length of time outside of the United States. And I showed the book to like a reporter, like a really good on the ground reporter that I know in Florida. And I was like, what do you think? And he was like, look, I think it's good. But, you know, I think this is accelerating a lot faster than you think, which is not what I thought I would hear. Right. Like what I thought I would hear is you're crazy. You're totally exaggerating the nature of the situation. But I think the closer to the ground that you are, the more worried you are. Right. Like if you go to these places in rural Ohio, like the Missouri-Illinois border, these places, like it's troubling. So the hope is that, I mean, America is the great country of hope. Right. Like there's no country that has as much hope in it as the United States. So if any country can reinvent itself, it's probably the United States. But at this point, I think the changes that are required are going to be extremely sizable. Right. They're on the level of a second republic, I think, if it's going to be preserved, or a state of defederalization that's so complete that it in effect isn't really one country anyway, which is also, you know, probably the most likely outcome. I mean, the abortion ruling is kind of already putting that into effect. There's like multiple countries within the United States.
So after writing this book and really dystopian story or series of stories, ideas almost, will we see something utopian from you? Are you thinking in a different way about what's next?
I would love to do that. Yeah, that'd be great, wouldn't it? I should do that. Or a children's book or something. I mean, God knows I don't need to be interviewing more Nazis with PhDs and law degrees. That's not how I need to spend more of my life, because it's exhausting investigating this darkness, right? But yeah, I actually think there needs to be some kind of utopian science fiction. I think it's time for that. I'm not sure if I'm the guy to do it, but maybe I'll use this AI to write it. But I think there's definitely a need to imagine futures, right? Because, like, I mean, one of the things about breakdown is that something will come after, right? There was one guy I was interviewed on, like, a Newsmax show, and one guy asked me, like, would a civil war even be that bad a thing? And I was like, well, you know, 3% of your population died the last time. Like, you know, 25% of the white male population of South Carolina died. There's widespread political murder. So, no, I would hope that you could come to something better than a civil war as a way of talking yourself out of these problems. But, yeah, it is going to require pretty drastic change at this point.
Stephen, thank you so much for joining us today.
This was so great to hear from you. Amazing. Thank you.
Pleasure, guys.
Thanks for listening. To hear more episodes of At a Distance, you can find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or Stitcher. You can follow us on Instagram at slowdown.tv. To sign up for our weekly newsletter exploring the five senses, head to our website at www.slowdown.tv.